Welcome to the Copernik Global Investors quarterly conference call. All participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of the call. Today's call is being recorded. Here to introduce David Ibn is Qasim Jafar. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy day and for joining us for a Q4 call with Dave Ibn, Lead Portfolio Manager and CIO of Copernik Global Investors. We think it is important to start off the call by letting you know that we realize how difficult your role can be at times. Clients trust you to be there for advice and guidance, and at times you serve as a psychologist and handholder, and our performance has not made your job any easier. We are truly grateful for your ongoing patience and support. We can make every effort, and we make every effort to be as transparent with our portfolio and process as possible, and appreciate you participating on this call. Before handing the call over to Dave, I would like to provide you with a quick firm and strategy update. Overall, as of the close of business last week, we're currently managing around $1.2 billion in total firm assets. Majority of those assets are in our Copernik Global All-Cap strategy, which is right around $1.18 billion. As a firm, we remain financially viable and healthy and continue to invest in our people and firm. And during the fourth quarter, we added to our investment team and institutional services team. Also, over the past couple of months, we saw institutional interest dramatically pick up with multiple new and reputable clients that funded us with around $400 million, with an additional $250-plus more million of assets that we have won and are currently onboarding for the first quarter of 2015. This vote of confidence has been reassuring as some old clients and new prospects understand the opportunity this drawdown presents. Overall, we remain steadfast in our belief and conviction that our portfolio holds tremendous upside potential. By almost any metric you look at, this is the cheapest portfolio Dave has ever managed. What gets us even more excited is the fact that we own some of the most dominant businesses in their respective industry that happen to be trading at or close to all-time low valuations. We are committed to our time-tested process and discipline, which has served Dave and his team well for many years as one of the leading global managers of the last two decades. And with that, I'll pass it over to you, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Qasim, and thank you to everybody for dialing on it. I'd just start by saying Happy New Year to everybody. We, for one, are very happy to welcome 2015 coming off the end of last year. We appreciate everybody's support and for calling in to hear our message. We'll say the investment commentary that was, what, three quarters done back in October is finally in final editing and compliance right now, so hopefully we'll get that on the website before too long. In that commentary, we're really looking at the market and analyzing why the market seems so detached from reality. Or maybe it's fairer to say why the market's reality is so detached from Copernik's perception of reality. One can, in these circumstances, cavalierly dismiss the market as being wrong and trudge forward, but we all know that arrogance is dangerous in our business. But the other extreme, assuming that the market is correct, is virtually equally as misguided. It's especially misguided at inflection points. Anytime a stock goes our way or goes against us, we always analyze where we were right, where we were wrong, when we were lucky or when we were unlucky or merely just too early. It's important to analyze those distinctions. When the whole portfolio does really great or horribly relative to the markets, rigorous analysis is, of course, in order. Given our really high active share, really great and really horrible relative performance are pretty common occurrences, so we're always looking at such things. The fourth quarter of 1999 and the third quarter of 2008 were remarkably bad for us. At that point, we did our own analysis and pretty much let the clients witness our self-analysis. Fortunately, we correctly concluded at those times that the market was really bonkers and stayed our course, and what followed were two of the best performance periods of our career. Once again, coming off 4 months that were equally appalling until those other two periods of time. We have done a lot of self-examination. That's what the commentary is about. But that's what we propose to do with this call, too, is talk about the results of our self-analysis on this. Where are we wrong or where is the market wrong? We once again conclude that the market is probably off its rocker, and that's presenting great opportunities. But what we want to do is talk about what's happened and what we see, and leave it up to each of you to make your own conclusions where the market might be right and where the market may be offering us great opportunities. People can argue whether the market's efficient or not efficient, but people, I don't think, could ever argue that the market's not emotional and has wild extremes from one point of view to another. So if we look, say, 3-4 years ago, let's start with gold and commodities. 3 or 4 years ago, people were pretty excited about commodities. They were pretty excited about gold. And gold had gone up 12 straight years. Commodities had quite a run. Everybody knew that the emerging markets were going to grow very fast for a long period of time, and they were going to have this voracious consumption, and that was going to be good for gold and good for commodities. They also knew that the central banks were likely to print a lot of money, and printing a lot of money should be very good for gold and for a lot of commodities. We, having owned a lot of commodities in the past, did not buy into commodities for the most part. For the last 3 years, we have owned almost no industrial commodities. We've owned very little chemicals. We're sort of agnostic on it. We like the fundamentals, but some of that was priced in. Wasn't something we owned. And so gold, we sold half of at the top, but over the last couple of years have gone back to a very heavy investment in gold. What's happened over that time? The market's appraisal and what we think has actually happened couldn't be further apart. In an environment that turned out to be a lot weaker than most people thought, industrial commodities have tended to disappoint people one after another. Yet price of gold's right where it was 3 years ago. Gold has hung in there. Why other commodities does not. On the surface, we got it right. And where people worried they might print a bit of, you know, a good amount of money, they printed way more money than anybody could have imagined. So there again, the fundamentals for gold actually improved more than anybody would have thought. So we seem to have owned the right substance and have avoided the wrong ones. We did avoid losing money in commodity stocks. It didn't do us any good because the market trounced the price of gold mining stocks. In our mind, gold mining stocks are not worth less than they were 3 years ago, but the market is selling them for way less than they were a few years ago. We view this as the market making a mistake. We think that with gold having had their 40% correction, the stocks have fallen so much that we're in decent shape if the price of gold stays here. But we're also cognizant of the fact that the fundamentals argue for way higher prices of gold. The incentive price, if gold is a commodity, would require probably a doubling in the price of gold. If gold is money, which it has been for 6,000 years or something, the price could weigh more than double. So if gold stays here, the stocks are probably too cheap. If gold goes to some sort of economic equilibrium over time, there is many multiples upside on these stocks. So we don't think the stocks are worth less. We think they're selling for less. We think people have gone from kind of liking them 3 years ago to hating them about as much as they can hate something. So, gold has done fine and should do well. Gold stocks have been punished and should bounce back. Fundamentals do not support the current price of gold stocks. We think that they support much higher prices. Energy, pretty much the same thing. If you look at our portfolio in the last few years, recently we bought Lukoil, but other than that, we have not owned oil. Yeah, and that looked bad for a while because oil was the one thing doing really well. We were once again sort of agnostic on gold. On oil. Sure, it could have been worth $80. Could be worth $100. Could be worth $120. Who knows? But when it's selling at $120, where's our edge versus others? We said if people can drill for oil and make a lot of money at $110, and everybody's doing that, and people are borrowing money like crazy, maybe we'll let other people do that, and we'll go with the ones that have pretty compelling fundamentals and aren't expanding, that haven't been expanding, where demand is growing and supply is not, and that should argue for the price holding up. And so, we've tended to own some natural gas and some coal, and uranium, of course, has been something we've been fond of for a while. And once again, if you just look at the facts, we got it right. The price of oil has plunged almost in half, and over half in some grades. The price of uranium's up. The price of coal is hanging in there. The price of natural gas in different parts of the world, some going up and some going down, but hanging in there. And so we've bought really inexpensive stocks on commodities that didn't fall in price and avoided the one that fell in price. So we got it right, except for the market punished us as they beat the hell out of coal stocks and have knocked uranium stocks to multi-year lows, too. We think the market's making a colossal mistake. And once again, if we are, in fact, right, these stocks could go up many times. We're not looking for 20% gain. We're looking for multiples. If the fundamentals are what they appear to be. Another area, I think 3-4 years ago, people thought that emerging markets grow faster than developed markets. And so maybe emerging markets are a better place to be than some of the developed markets. And that was all the rage. Must own the BRICS and shouldn't own the U.S. because the U.S. is a basket case with too much debt and can't grow. And turns out people were right. Growing markets do grow faster than mature markets have and certainly will. But boy, were they wrong. The emerging markets grew, but at a rate that disappointed them. And investors don't like to be disappointed, and so they've slaughtered many of the emerging market indices in this particular stock. The U.S. has gone up nicely. I guess from 2009 till now, it probably started out too cheap and went up because people had priced in overly pessimistic views. The U.S. was the place to be when everybody hated it. Now people love the U.S. We love the U.S., but loving the U.S. and loving the U.S. markets should be separate and distinct things. People should like markets because prices are cheap, not because a company or a country is a good thing. And so in the United States in 1929, people were correct that there was going to be 90 good years on the way or whatever, but they lost 90% of their money owning the U.S. stock market. In 1972, they were right, the U.S. was going to do great. The market dropped 50% in the next 2 years, ditto for 1999 and 2007. The U.S. now is a great market. It's gone up six and a half years. Has it gone up because fundamentals have gotten better? A little. Has it gotten because stock valuations have re-rated? Absolutely. History and logic would say when valuations get re-rated to a high level, they are not safer. They are, in fact, much less safe. We love the U.S. We find the U.S. market to be risky. But in the short term, not owning the expensive market has been painful for us because, really, for the last 6-7 months, the world markets seem to be in a bear market, and the U.S. market is up nicely, covering that up. I'd like to add the U.S. is over half of the all-country world index. That's really unprecedented. And, yeah, I think those of you that listened to us in the past, we talk often about how markets are capitalization weighted, so they reflect when too much capital is pouring into any one area. Too much capital always overwhelms the possibility for meaningful returns going forward. So buying energy at a third of the index in 1980 and buying tech in 99 and Japan in 1989 and finance in 2007 all proved to be disastrous, not just poor, disastrous. The U.S. is over half. It is worth more than every other country in the act we put together. U.S. is a good country. The U.S. market is dangerous. And if you look at it on price to book value and price to cyclically adjusted PE and price to Tobin's Q's replacement and sales and you name it, 1999 is there to cushion it. But other than 1999, this is the most expensive the market's ever been. So it hurt us not owning it last year. We do not think we made a mistake. We think it's a matter of timing. These kind of valuations are unlikely to work out for people. Did the U.S. perform because it actually became a small growth economy that's going to grow great for the next 10 or 20 years and the emerging markets became mature? No. It's the U.S. is a big mature market that can't grow fast for the long period of time. Law of large numbers. One of the main reasons the U.S. did way better than other markets was currency. The U.S. Currency was really hated 4 or 5 years ago. Many well-off clients always came saying, how do we get our money out of the dollar? How do we protect ourselves from this QE and the madness of the U.S. and too much debt and the deficits year after year? And a central bank that seems to think it's a good thing to destroy purchasing power. How do we get our money offshore? How do we get it into emerging markets? How do we get it into gold? People are pretty much unanimously disliking something, often it gets to be too cheap. And with hindsight, the dollar was too cheap. It was a nice time to buy the dollar. Now the dollar's had this big run. Is it had a big run because it's worth more? Is it had a big run because the U.S. hasn't run trade deficits? The U.S. hasn't run budget deficits? The U.S. didn't print $4 trillion out of thin air? No, those things happened. Yeah, the currency has been weakened, and other currencies have been weakened also. But they have weakened the currency a lot, and it does take way more dollars than at any time in history to buy health care, to buy insurance, to buy tuition, to buy art, to buy collectibles, to buy real estate in any areas that the well-off live, and those sort of things. So the fact that the dollars had such a big run versus pound, euro, yen, and things like that is not a reason to like it more. The time to buy the dollar is when everybody hated it. I suspect now is a beautiful time to let go a few of those dollars, but time will tell. But the dollar has not gone up because they didn't, in fact, print a bunch of money. And the markets sometimes get excited when they think that they're going to stay easy for a long time. That's not good for currencies. Time will still tell. One thing that's come back is stocks like SkyWest. It was very interesting. The stock grows book value most every year. People like to look at earnings, but on cyclical companies, we prefer to look at how much wealth is accruing over time as opposed to whether it's accruing at a faster rate one year and a slower the next and faster the next, is which, of course, cyclicals do. For some reason, the stock almost fell in half for no particular reason. Since then, it's bounced back. So it got down to 30% of book value. Now it's bounced back to half of book value. But, we like things like that. Half a book value for a company that has a dominant niche, There was no reason why the market one day thought it was worth 12.5 and then thought it was worth 7.5 and then 12.5 again. I find it interesting that they teach efficient markets in school. Bonds are one of the best examples of inefficiency we've ever noticed. I think we've pointed out in the past, NTT in Japan was the largest market cap in the whole world in 1987, I think it was. A couple of years ago, we were buying it at 4x free cash flow, and most of the CapEx was done. They had one of the most modern systems in the world. Then it bounced rather than fell. But then the next year, they liked that, and they didn't like emerging market phones, so we were able to buy emerging market phones. There's times like 99 where every phone in the world was too expensive. There was times like 2002 when almost every phone in the world was too cheap. There are times where people would give away wireline because they thought the whole future was wireless. And there's times that they give away wireless because it didn't grow as fast as people thought, or there's too much competition. So over time, it's worked out pretty well to be able to do that. I think 9 months ago or whenever it was, they had taken China Mobile from one of the biggest market caps on Earth to a value stock, and we were able to take advantage of that. It's bounced back a good bit from there, but we like the fact that people always change their mind about whether you want to own emerging or developed or wireline or wireless, or whether you want to own cable or satellite or fiber optics. As the market gets emotional, we like to be on the other side of such things. Within emerging markets, one thing that is hurt really badly is our exposure to Russia. Once again, it pretty much comes down to currencies, because what if we owned? We view ourselves as owning good businesses, and we own some of the biggest, strongest, most competitively advantaged companies on Earth, whether it's the world's largest gas company at 3x earnings, or whether it's one of the world's most dominant banks at single-digit PEs and discounts to book value, owning utilities that are the cheapest, cleanest on Earth at a fifth of what it might take to replace those properties. One of the few affordable technology companies on Earth is there. So we've owned companies like that. The companies have done okay, and their stocks have done okay. The currency was murdered. Could be that over time we'll look and say, yep, the currency deserves to be murdered, but usually in those circumstances, people just get emotional, just like they did with the rupee a year and a half ago when they pounded the rupee. It was a great time to be investing in India. Now they're pounding the ruble. There's a lot of things that matter on currencies, and we can argue or not argue about them. We will just point out that if you're comparing Russia to a lot of other countries in the world, they have trade surpluses. That should be a positive. They have roughly balanced budgets and been surpluses for many years. They have almost no debt. They have a higher backing of gold than a lot of other countries. They have lots of resources. And so a case can be made that it actually should be a stronger currency than others. All we know is from a dollar standpoint, the businesses in Russia have gotten a lot cheaper, and we run negative interest rates in the U.S., and they run positive interest rates there. A case can be made for the ruble, but we're just going to keep focusing on owning really good businesses at really cheap prices, and it might be, as an article came out last week, say some of the stocks in Russia are the bargain of a century. We agree. Yeah, I think they went on to say that it didn't matter that it was a bargain, that you should avoid bargains. But, we've been in the business for 33 years of buying bargains. It works way more often than it doesn't. And we plan to continue to do that. So, we can look at debt and what the bond markets have done. 33 years ago when I came into business, people hated, but I cannot tell how strongly they hated the bond market at 14% interest rate on long bonds. Now bonds are priced at levels that make no sense to anybody. So people will say, well, so what? It's a higher yield than they have in Europe, therefore it must be good. Relative pricing never made sense to us. If something's way overpriced, I don't care that somebody can point out something else on earth that's more overpriced. 2.5% yield or even 3% yield for a claim on a currency that's actively being printed where the Federal Reserve has a goal to make it lose purchasing power. We'll let other people do that. Yeah, I understand the market went up. I think our calculations show if the rates drop to 2%, somebody could make another 16% this year. But if rates go back to 4, people will lose 20-some-odd%. If rates go back to where they were in the early 80s, people are going to lose 80% of their money in the bond market. So we're not going to predict that bonds go up or down this year or any particular year. Sometime in the future, bonds will be a disaster. We'll let the people that are smart enough to time it, and we're just going to step to the sidelines and let other people risk 80% of their money thinking they can make 3%. The fundamentals for the bond market have not gotten better. They've gotten worse. The yield's gotten lower. Once again, I think the market is making at least as bad a mistake buying bonds now as they did not buying bonds when rates were 14 plus. And people then said, so what if Paul Volcker's going to try to whip inflation? Can't be done. The Fed is incapable of eliminating inflation. Everybody says the Fed is incapable of creating inflation, and deflation is the risk. One of the few things where I absolutely agree with Ben Bernanke is his quote that, you know, we have a printing press or the electronic equivalent, and any determined Federal Reserve can and will create inflation. We know they can. 2.75% is nowhere near enough compensation to take the risk that they will fail. They'll most likely succeed. So we look at our portfolio now and say, tough 4 months in the market, but not a tough 4 months for the fundamentals of these businesses. These businesses are doing really well in most cases. The fundamentals have improved in most cases. And when you add it all up to be able to buy good oligopoly businesses and do so at 60% of book value, I don't think I've seen anything that good in 33 years in the business. So we wish that the last 4 months hadn't happened. On the other hand, we love the opportunities that the last 4 months have created and the last 3 years have created. Unbelievable bargains for unbelievable businesses in the areas that people are going to want and need to be in over the next 10 years, we believe. So that's our analysis of the situation. The stocks are down because they're down, not because the businesses are worthless. And with that, I'll stop for questions.
Thank you. Once again, it is *1 if you do have a question. Also, if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We'll go to our first question, and that will come from Ben Klaus with Merrill Lynch.
Thanks for doing the call. I have two questions, I guess. One, the first one is on the gold miners, and I guess I understand you're a contrarian investor, and then that makes a lot of sense. Why do you think other value investors may not see that opportunity? I'm mainly a value investor, and I have a lot of other managers, and I'm curious as to what some of the other value investors, what the reasons for why they don't think gold miners are a good investment at these prices.
Let's go at that from various ways, because it's a very good question. On the one hand, as a sort of contrarian leading investor, the fact that no growth investors like it and no value investors like it is music to our ears. But like I say, analysis is the important thing. We know why growth guys don't like it, because growth is impossible. That's one of the bull arguments that, there is no gold out there. You can't grow any faster than you can pull it out of the ground, which is what, 1% a year plus or minus, so not a growth. Value investors, we are big on the fact that value is absolute, it's imperative, it's prerequisite, but it is a very difficult thing. People make a mistake to say value is low PE, or value is the discounted future cash flows. Value is a lot of things, but value is something that is worth something to people in the future. And somebody wrote an article a few weeks back. It was fascinating. They were calling gold a 6,000-year-old bubble. And they concluded that it might go on for another 6,000 years, but it was a bubble. I don't know what that means. That 12,000-year-old bubble, I don't see as really a possibility. You can look at gold itself and say, well, intrinsic value, as some people believe, is the present value of future cash flows, and the cash flow thrown off by a piece of metal is zero, and therefore it's intrinsically worthless. A lot of people believe that. We think it's ridiculous. We think it's backwards even. We think that future cash flow comes from value. To elaborate, the Mona Lisa, I know very little about art, but I know enough to know that the Mona Lisa is valuable. But if you ascertained its value by the present value of future cash flows, it's worth nothing because it doesn't generate cash flow. And an empty building generates no cash flow. So is it worth nothing? And then you rent it out and all of a sudden it's worth something? I don't think so. Yeah, if somebody is employed and has a lot of skills, are they worth nothing until they get their job and then they're worth something as a human being? I don't think so. I think Warren Buffett, who doesn't like gold, but some level he must, but his view that if they own businesses that sell candy that people want, people will exchange cash for that candy. It doesn't matter if cash is dollar or yen or euro or south, or shark's teeth, as he thinks. And so I'd say that something that's held its value for 6,000 years is not a bubble. It is something that's valuable. And 2 years from now, and 50 years from now, and 150 years from now, somebody will be able to take gold and exchange it for whatever the currency is and generate cash, just like the Mona Lisa could be sold for cash. I think if the Louvre took it down to Christie's or whatever, they'd get a lot. So I think that's one thing. Value investors make a mistake by thinking that somebody's estimate of future cash flow, discounted back at somebody's estimate of what the future cash flow discount rate ought to be, ascertains the value. I think that's wrong. Secondly, gold is worth what it's worth. What's it worth above the ground? All right, we, 1,200 or whatever. In the ground? There are times, most times actually in history, where people say we will pay a nice premium for gold in the ground because it's got more optionality, it's got more leverage. If the price of gold goes up, as many people think it must when they're printing money, wouldn't you rather have optionality? Wouldn't you rather have a business? Wouldn't you want to own a business that has the ability to find more gold, and the most likely place to find gold is next to the gold that already exists? And so for many reasons, owning a business is way better than owning a piece of metal. That's absolutely accurate. Now their view, which is also accurate, is that owning a gold miner is a horrible way to own gold, because if you have gold in the bank, you don't have to worry about the geology not working out and the chemistry not working out. And you don't have to worry about a management team doing something incredibly stupid to destroy your wealth. And you don't have to worry, at least generally, you don't have to worry about governments coming in and confiscating that wealth from you and coming up with royalties and taxes and all kinds of things. And so there are lots of reasons to not like gold in the ground owned by some company in some country. People's psychology will vacillate between only focusing on the negative and only focusing on the positive. Whenever they do that, there's usually an opportunity of thinking the opposite of what everybody else is thinking. So if you look now, I would say a lot of true value investors would go along with price is more important than anything. As Howard Marks points out, you can take a portfolio of bonds that are distressed, none of them paying anything. They're all in default. And if you buy a portfolio of those things at 5 cents on the dollar, it's really low risk. You can get recoveries that are way more than 5 cents. You make 30 cents. You make a lot of money with low risk. I would say if people are pretty much giving away gold in the ground because they have such disdain for the gold miners, that value investors ought to say maybe there's something there. Why? Well, let's do a DCF. If you do a DCF model and say, let's assume the price of gold goes to 800 and we discount it back at 10%, it's worth nothing. If you say, let's assume that gold goes up 10% a year and you discount it at zero because gold's money, then it's worth almost infinity. You're a huge upside. We can come up with, oh, the price of oil's just dropped. That's great for their costs, which is true. The incremental cost is 2,400. Let's put that in there, or let's put 800. The DCF can give you any number you want. What we tend to do is say, well, what we've got is two things. We have sort of a margin of safety, which we like, because we're buying these things so cheaply that, yeah, if they just, the price of gold does nothing and managements do a few stupid things and we just liquidate this thing out, these things are fairly priced, and in many cases we have upside. And then we get free optionality of, what if the price of gold goes back to 1900, these stocks go up 3-4 times. Remember when they're at 1900, these guys had strong cash flow. People were loving these stocks. These could go up 3, 4, or 5 times if the price goes there. If the price goes to sort of incentive value that would actually lead to future supply growth, it's, you know, 2400, something like that, who knows how much these stocks can go. And so if somebody, you know, it's like I say, analyzes this on DCF, you can get any answer you want. But if you do it on a bunch of optionalities and you say, what if the options are all worth nothing, then I probably don't even lose money. These stocks are so cheap. What if I put in some simple, not even bullish assumptions? Maybe I make 3, 4, or 5 times my money. And, you know, what if the fact that they've printed $15,000 for every ounce of gold we have, yeah, what if the price of gold got to a third of 15,000? The upside's almost infinite. So if somebody does a Monte Carlo analysis, different simulations, there's all kinds of looked at it, we can all argue about what the fair assumptions are, but if the downside is effectively zero and the upside is many, many times, I think that's a value. But I tried to explain, I think, the various reasons others can have a different view, and that's the beautiful thing about the markets. We can all have different views. We see tons of value.
I appreciate it. It's a complicated one.
Yeah.
And moving on, we'll go to Todd Brady with Oppenheimer.
Hi, just circling back and following up on your comments on gold and the value of gold. If a commodity's in a truly deflationary spiral and miners become cheap, one region might become cheaper than another region, but the underlying argument about the value of the commodity at the end of the day would remain the same. And where I'm going with that comment is a couple of things I've heard as an investor with your firm is buying companies below liquidation value. And these are foreign companies that you're buying at, quote, below liquidation value. Can you maybe help educate me on what your idea of below liquidation value is, especially in certain regions around the world which are experiencing pretty severe political headwinds and countries that are not afraid to repatriate assets and commodities that we all find as values here as Americans? And then I have one follow-up. Thank you.
Okay, sure. All right, so I'll take a crack at that. As we talked about the last question, value is a interesting and complicated thing. We, like a lot of value investors, like the concept of a margin of safety. Yeah, some people look at a margin of safety of, you know, can I buy it at 30% less than we think it's worth? And we do several things. We can say margin of safety can be relative to other valuations or other backstops. But one thing we do is use this concept of liquidation value as sort of a backdrop margin of safety. So, liquidation value, probably very few of these management teams are actually going to liquidate their company. But what we do is say, suppose they did. Yeah, if we went in and bought the entire company, we paid for all the equity, we assumed all the debt, we paid everything we would have to pay to finish building the mine. We paid all the costs of extracting everything. We, put in the fact that some of that you don't recover everything. Maybe there's 80 or 90% recovery rate, so some of the gold is lost. Then you put in the taxes and royalties to other countries and, how much gold could we get? So if we paid all that money and pulled that gold out of the ground and just sold it for more than we put into it, that gives us some comfort. There's not a lot of businesses, especially in this market. You don't go in and buy Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson and say, well, if it hits the fan, everything goes bad. What if I just liquidate this company and I get my money back? No, you get pretty much nothing back. Here, if they liquidate, we get our money back. So that gives us a nice comfort, margin of safety, and then that makes it easier to own this massive optionality to where our upside is 3, 4, 5, 10 times if things go right, and our downside is somewhat protected by this margin of safety. So that's how we calculate it, all the cash it would take to bring it above ground and sell it at today's price. And then, your other question's important. I've learned way back in school, people feared markets but didn't fear business risk as much because business risk can be diversified and market risk can't. Now people don't perceive markets as risky, but businesses are risky. They'll sell us cheap businesses, but you can diversify it. And so one thing we do is say, there's been times where Australia tried to throw a tax on. There's times where everybody in Latin America seems to consistently be increasing the tariffs they'll throw onto things. In Mongolia, they want to own more of the mine. And in the U.S., we've had windfall profit taxes on oil when they've made money in the past. In Canada, everybody has their thing, and we don't know who's going to do what to us when. So we think it's good to own properties in lots of different countries. We don't want too many of them in any one country, even if that one country is the U.S. As a matter of fact, two of our cheapest ones happen to be U.S. companies that are running into more obstacles than foreign companies do. It is really, this, the regulation and and political backlash and stuff, U.S. is sometimes a tough place to do business. So we want to do business here and Canada and emerging markets and all over. That, we think, lowers the risk. But also, we are not indifferent to if we can buy a nice mine in Canada, or we can buy a nice mine in Ecuador. We want a way bigger discount for the mine in Ecuador. We've always done that. It's worked out well. We've found out in the past that there's times where we can buy assets in risky places like Argentina, Brazil, DRC, Papua New Guinea, Mongolia, Romania, and have ended up making a lot of money despite the fact that, say, Venezuela bid us just because we were getting 90% margins of safety in some of these things. And so the winners went up 4 or 5 times, 10 times in some cases. We do that. We look for, we want more upside, less downside, or more upside relative downside to invest in Mongolia or Russia than we would in Canada. So we put a lot of time into that risk management.
Sure. I understand that, and that's what excites me about being an investor with your firm. That being said, currencies don't lie, bond markets don't lie unless governments are involved, which they are. Assuming that this deflationary storm that seems to be happening globally continues over the next 6, 9, 12 months, being a value investor, Q1 of 2015, what are the top 2 areas of investment opportunities that you guys are finding? And secondly, the 2 best regions that you guys are finding investment opportunities within those 2 questions. Thank you.
Sure. Well, it's a lot there. If you look at sort of deflation, it seems to have taken on different meanings to different people. I'm more old school Austrian or whatever. I believe that the act of printing money is inflation, and therefore printing money is inflation, shrinking the money supply is deflation, and by that definition, the U.S. inflation rate just went to zero. But over the last 6 years, the inflation was 400%. They quintupled the money supply, 4 times new money, massive inflation, whereas Europe deflated the last few years. They actually shrunk the balance sheet of the ECB. Now they sound like they're going to want to print a bunch of money, so they're going to follow with a bunch of inflation. And, so if you print a bunch of money, which the world has, and the Japanese are going nuts, and the bunch of money is being printed. So I would say that in general, we are in a massively inflationary environment where the U.S. is taking a breather now, but the world's not. And when you print the money, it debases currency, but it's not the same as to say prices are going to go up. Prices of something will go up. So the world's been massively inflationary since 2008, and as we said before, the prices of assets that are most associated with where the money's going. Where's the money going? It's going to the governments and it's going to the rich. And so what do governments buy? Governments buy healthcare, and the price of healthcare is screaming. They pay for education. The price of education is screaming. Yeah, rich people buy real estate in Manhattan and West L.A. and Hong Kong and London, and the prices of real estate are screaming there while they're going falling other places. I don't see deflation, and I see various pricings dropping. The price of oil went from 10 to 147 to 34 to 120 back to 50. That's the price of a commodity going up and down. That's not inflation or deflation. I wouldn't say over those 30 years we had massive deflation those two times that the price of oil stole a lot. We didn't. So that's just the price of a commodity going from one level to another. But that's all just interesting stuff. We, as investors, we look for bargains, and you read in people's expectations, and if they're really bullish or really bearish, they're probably wrong. If they're in the middle, then the opinions matter. But people can get really, really bearish to where they give things away. They seem really risky, but isn't it interesting how what seems the riskiest usually turns out to be the least risky? Whether it's, junk bonds didn't seem risky before Drexel fell, and they seemed risky after, where in reality it turned out to be the opposite. And, real estate was not risky in 07, and everybody pointed out there's never been real estate dropping everywhere over a period, and then, of course, it dropped everywhere because people take a lot of risk when they don't see the risk. And then real estate was pretty cheap a few years ago when people viewed it as risky. Currencies and bonds, you say, would be fair if it wasn't for government. But as you pointed out, government's in there manipulating, and the currencies are all over. It doesn't mean anything. So we look at all of them and say, all right, fine, we can agree or disagree. But when it comes to straight valuation, I've never seen anything in my life cheaper than Russia is right now. It's just obscenely cheap. And the fundamentals for Russia are really good. I understand the emotions. I understand that people passionately hate Russia. I grew up hating Russia, Cold War. I understand it all. But I think people let emotions get in the way. I think Russia will prove not to be all that risky. It'll prove to be maybe the bargain of my entire lifetime. We will see. We've already talked a lot on gold, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, but let me just reiterate that it's not really often you see something that has the chance to go up many multiples on the upside, but the downside is probably pretty protected. And on almost any analysis you can put on it, and so extremely interesting investment to us. Uranium and coal. People go back and forth. They like energy. They don't like energy. They like it. They don't. People used to think that 7 billion people headed to 8 billion was going to strain the economy. And Jeremy Grantham was writing these, what I think are great pieces, talking about the miracle of the last 200 years and why the next might be more challenging. And now everybody ridicules him, or I think he'll be proven to be right. I think 7 or 8 billion people are going to consume too much energy, so I believe that energy is a good place to be. Within energy, like I say, half a year ago, we were pointing out that oil was fine, but we didn't want to own any. We saw real bargains in uranium. The price of uranium had fallen from 147 to 28, and I just said that seems unrealistic. It's going to cost $70, $80 plus to get anybody to build new mines, and so much of our supply came from Russian bombs being turned to fuel, and that program ended 14 months ago. That's over. The price needs to go up. Well, guess what? The price has gone up. Went up from high 20s to the high 30s, and the price of the stocks has not gone up. So we love uranium. We find the fundamentals are interesting. As an aside, whether we're talking Russia or we're talking energy, I just finished a book that was recommended to me called The Colder War, talks a lot about energy. It talks a lot about Russia. It also talks about a little about gold and fiat currencies and whatnot. A really compelling read. I'd recommend that to all of you. But, yeah, I would say uranium and coal, gold, and Russia. Pretty amazing opportunity.
David, a couple of more areas of the world outside of Russia that right now are screaming buys?
You've got, in the rest of the BRICS, India seems to have gotten away, but Brazil has really compelling values. China's mixed. There's still some really cheap stocks there, and others have had their run, I think, but we're still finding stuff there. Korea still has some pretty interesting things. One-offs in various others of the emerging markets. So that all seems interesting. Sectors of the emerging market. Nowadays, it's even hard to even talk about emerging markets because they're viewed as a niche. I don't view them as a niche. I view them as most of the world, most of the people, most of the geography, over half of the economy, most all the future growth. So rather than say emerging markets, let's just say we're finding lots of pockets in the emerging markets that are very exciting.
I appreciate your time. Thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Aubrey Sharfman with Merrill Lynch.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for everything over the years. Quick question for you. In the early part of your introduction about the portfolio, you cited the experience of the internet bubble and the 08 situation. And in my mind, both those periods was a period where active managers, even vanilla active managers, had an easier time once things burst beating the market because the multiples were so high. I find the challenge right now is given that the multiples are only like modestly above average, what do you think will be the catalyst, since in my view, at least over the next year, year and a half, it'll be still harder for thoughtful active managers to outperform?
Thanks, Aubrey, and good question. Let's come at it from a couple ways. We'll come back to the valuation, but let's just, to the market as a whole. Active versus passive, I view that as cyclical. Yeah, I don't believe in efficient markets, but let's just start with they're somewhat efficient. And if they're somewhat efficient, passive management makes a lot of sense because if, in fact, information goes out equally to everybody and everybody rationally analyzes it and everybody comes to their rational conclusion and everybody buys the thing that makes sense, then why not buy the index and save the fees and the transaction costs and everything else? And so everybody starts doing that in the 90s. And once you buy the index, though, the assumptions for the efficient markets are gone because you're not doing analysis anymore. You don't even know what you're buying. Yeah, in 1998, people didn't know that they were making Coca-Cola, a beverage company, the second largest market cap on earth. They were buying it not based on any analysis. They were buying it because of the index. And so, the more money goes into the index, the less efficient the market is. Yeah, the index goes up. And so then people say, well, not only is the index efficiently tracking the market, it's going up more than the market, so that must be really good. So let's fire our active manager and let's hire the index. And so then the index goes more and the non-index stocks fall more, which makes people fire another active manager and buy the index manager. And I think the fact that stocks were really expensive in 99 is a secondary point. What was important is stocks in the index no longer represented the market. They were roughly four times expensive as the stocks that weren't in the index. So as that was happening, active managers looked stupid and the index looked like a godsend. But N99, like I say, it's four times expensive as non-index things. So then for the next 7 years, we all get to look like geniuses, but it wasn't that we all became geniuses. It was the index went from stupidly overvalued to eventually fairly, if not undervalued, relative to other things. And so active managers had their heyday, and everybody was getting tired of passive management, and they did that at the wrong time. So the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years has been a pretty good time to be an indexer again. Now people aren't so much buying the index fund, they're buying the ETF, but the same sort of thing. You look industry by industry. The stocks that are in the consumer ETF are more expensive than the consumer stocks that aren't in it. And the stocks that are in the emerging market ETFs are often more expensive than the ones that aren't in the ETF. And, you know, so people are wheeling and dealing and they're buying. No one's buying an ETF because they analyzed every company in the ETF and said, these are good businesses at good prices, I want to buy them. They say, yeah, I'm bullish on consumer. Hey, I'm pretty bullish on India. Let's go buy it. And that's been happening for a number of years now. So I think, once again, stocks that are in the ETFs are too expensive relative. And we are pretty, I hope and believe, far along this process of fire the active manager and just do smart beta and all that stuff. But I think we're at the end of that trend, not the beginning. Time will tell, but that's the most important thing. To quickly go back to your valuation, though, I think 99 was pure price bubble. Yeah, the stock sold at infinity in many cases. it was ridiculous. Now it's a profitability bubble. So if profits margins can stay double normal forever, then stocks are not cheap, but to your point, they're not that expensive. So then you say, well, all right, so they're not that expensive on PE, but they are expensive on price to book, and they are expensive on price to liquidation, they are expensive on price to GDP, and they're, yeah, and so why is it the PE not so bad? And like I say, it's the margin being double, and so if somebody has a Shiller, Cape-adjusted PE and stuff, then we're expensive. They were like 27 times or something like that. So we are not as bad as 1999, but we are worse than 1929. We are worse than anything in history on a normalized basis. Are we in a new reality where profit margins can stay double? No. Yeah, profits, you have to have some barriers to entry. If the cost of funds are zero and somebody's making 25%, lots of competition's going to come in, and they got unlimited access to capital to go after that. And the people that are making 26%, that money can't be reinvested at 26, so their margins get tugged. Our profit margins over the next 20 years are very likely to do what Japanese profit margins have done in the last 20 years, is they've tried zero-interest policy. So I do believe that profits normalize, and if profits do normalize, then we have a very expensive market. More importantly, though, I don't even care so much if I'm right or wrong about the U.S. being expensive, is that I'm very confident I'm getting way better bargains going outside of the U.S.
Dave, these are very compelling points. If at any point your analysts are able to put some of those points into like just two or three charts, I think that really helps us make your case. So very helpful.
Yeah, we would be happy to do that. Matter of fact, you know, twice a year right now we have offsites. We get everybody together and we work on what we can do to help our process and help you guys. And one of the topics is what more we can put up on the website in terms of charts like that and white papers and those sort of things. So we will do that, and we appreciate any feedback you have.
Thanks.
And moving on, we'll go to Scott Wilson with Morgan Stanley.
Hi. The question I had is if interest rates remain low for longer and Europe continues in arguably a deflationary mode, how does that affect how you think your fund might do?
Yeah, we're bottom up, and there's a lot of moving pieces there. Yeah, I saw a headline the other day that the euro drops on deflationary concerns, where, I don't know, it seems to me that deflation by definition is an increase in currency relative to products and things out there, my supply. So I don't know. I would think that if, you know, prices and money supply deflate in Europe, then the euro should actually go up against the dollar. And I don't know, everybody was damn sure that printing a bunch of dollars was going to make the dollar drop, and instead it went up. Now they're damn sure that the fact that we've stopped printing dollars, then they're going to print a bunch of yen and euro and francs, the dollar then must go up, and these other ones might fall, but I don't know. It didn't work that way here. So I'm agnostic. I don't know, the dollar might go up, might go down, might do whatever. But people tend to be using the prices of oil and a few other things dropping. They want to call that deflation, and they use that as an excuse to inflate. You see that throughout history. The 99 bubble was the fact that prices were dropping because technology was making them drop. That was a good thing. But the Fed said, oh, they can print a bunch of money. I believe that every central bank on earth is just itching to have their turn to print money. When it all said and done, the dollar may go up or down against the euro, and they might print and they might not, and whatnot. I think that'll all prove to be less important than if anybody decides to actually start cranking interest rates to way above inflation rates and stomp on the money supply everywhere. If that happens, it won't be good for our portfolio. It'll be worse for anybody else's portfolio. It'll be, of course, the death of the banking system. There'd be no banks or real estate companies or anything else left, so it's unlikely to happen. I would say as long as the central banks of the world take time using any excuse to print more money, I think that will be very, very good for our portfolio. If not, I still like our portfolio because I believe the most important predictor of future prices is the valuations now. And the valuations now are the best I've ever seen. So I tend to feel pretty good about things. The dollar's move will make us look a little bit better or a little bit worse than we otherwise would, is my view.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
And moving on, we'll go to Nikesh Patakia.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for taking the call. Quick question. In the past, I was going to get your thoughts on the steel industry. I know you own some positions in steel. You know, obviously right now, the world steel industry is facing low capacity utilization, squeezed margins obviously caused by the falling steel prices. And, you know, with the overall supply situation currently in China, you know, is it, you know, currently priced in today? I mean, we've seen essentially the price of iron ore, which has collapsed, you know, which is going to should benefit some of those producers in terms of lower input costs. Are there some major opportunities, you think, with some of the steel companies? You specifically mentioned Korea, and obviously a name that comes to mind, which, you know, you may or not consider, of course, is POSCO, which is trading pretty much the lowest price to book in essentially in the last 25 years. Look at your thoughts overall on the steel industry, maybe a recovery in terms of commodity prices and steel. And obviously the world's not going to stop using steel. And essentially, if you know, if you believe in that, are there some tremendous opportunities in that sector?
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of things to think about there. In general, for the last 13, 14 years, we've looked at materials and processing, and we've found that the market makes mistakes in the processing area and has made huge mistakes in the materials area. So we've generally preferred materials. We've preferred iron to steel. We've preferred petroleum to chemicals. And, you know, and so we've generally done it. We've preferred copper and whatnot to the people that are processing, and we haven't owned a lot of chemicals, so we have a higher level of confidence, I guess, on materials than processors. However, we take what the market gives us. And so we have off and on owned POSCO. We have off and on owned chemical companies or owned uranium as a clubbing. I owned aluminum as opposed to bauxite and that sort of thing. And so we're happy to do that. I mentioned earlier in the call that as much as we like materials, with the exception of precious metals, we really have not even owned materials for much of the last 3 or 4 years. But we, at these prices, we have to start relooking at iron and relooking at some of the base metals and relooking at, and say, energy, oil at these prices. So we are looking at some of the materials that we're processing. Once again, we're looking at some chemical companies and things which we haven't done in the past because they've come down. And steel, same thing. Iron, we like the fact that it's big mines in a few countries that are hard to replicate versus steel that can be replicated and many kinds is replicated. And the Chinese in the past have built lots of steel plants that didn't make any sense to us. Why would a high-cost country with expensive energy do that? But they did, so we haven't. Bosco is the sort of thing we look at at these sort of prices. It's getting more interesting, but we haven't done much in a long time. We have owned Japan Steel, which is part steel, but a lot of it's a play on the fact that people believe there's no nuclear reactors being built, and there are 60-some nuclear reactors being built, and whereas Japan Steel has more competition than they used to, enough's getting built that we think they're going to sell a lot of the pressure vessels, containment vehicles, and so that's more of a play on that. But steel and processors have gotten a lot more interesting, and we are looking at it. We're not far enough along that I can give you a concrete answer.
And next we'll go to Hal Heffelton with Merrill Lynch.
Thank you very much. Just curious, a lot of your stocks are, you know, all over the world, and do you guys have the opportunity to visit these companies, and or do you do most of your research, down in Tampa?
All right, yes to both, and let me explain. We do travel the world. We go out and we see lots of things. As to what and whether it's mandatory, there's some competitors we respect that don't want to meet management. They want to do their own analysis and not be swayed by a very gifted presenter versus a very bad one. And then there's other people that will buy nothing unless they've had a bunch of meetings with management and gone and visited everything. We say, what are we buying and why are we buying it? And so if we were to buy Nestle's, we would be happy to buy Nestle's without zipping over to Switzerland and spending a lot of time with them. We think we know the product, and we can talk to them on the phone, and we can read their reports and know the products. We don't happen to own it, but if we did, we would do that without meeting management. On turnaround situations, managements are very important to me. Yeah, we want to make sure that they can articulate a strategy that makes sense to us. A tough balance sheet combined with bad management is a bad combination. So we want the management team to be good. We like on technology companies to go out there and see how it's used or talk to customers, that sort of thing. We also, we've talked plenty on gold already, but gold is an area where we agree with the bears that there's challenges and some of the managements aren't so good. We meet with them, we travel out, and we've been to most of these mines. Yeah, we always pass along Mark Twain's joke that a mine is a hole in the ground with a liar standing next to it. So we do like to go out there and make sure that it's not just a hole in the ground, but there's hundreds of millions of worth of ball mills and sag mills and autoclaves and infrastructure being put in, and it's for real. So we Tampa's kind of nice. We know, like, Warren Buffett and John Templeton and people like that have said we want to be in Omaha or Bahamas and out of the thing and not get deluged with a short-term mentality. We like that, but we also like the fact that, you know, very often we are in New York, L.A., London, Asia. We do travel a lot, but we do it when we think it's important, and we don't do it just to check a box.
You bet. Thank you.
Sure.
And as a final reminder, star one for any questions. And there are no further questions at this time. I'll turn it back to our presenters for any additional or closing comments.
All right. Well, just want to thank everybody for listening in. These are particularly challenging times, but that often leads to particularly compelling times, too. We're pretty excited, but it has been a tough time, and we appreciate everybody's support. Thank you very much.
And that does conclude today's conference. We'd like to thank everyone for their participation.